Our next speaker from the forum Techno-Utopians and the Fate of the Earth is the famous ecofeminist Susan Griffin. Her topic is Women and Nature, Speed, Consciousness, and Quantification.
Radio EcoShock.
Next, I'd like to welcome Susan Griffin. Susan is a poet, essayist, playwright, and screenwriter. She's the author of over 20 books, including Women in Nature, which inspired the eco-feminist movement. Her book on nuclear weapons, A Chorus of Stones, The Private Life of War, was a New York Times notable book and a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Susan was named by Utney Reader as one of 100 visionaries for the new millennium. She's currently writing a book called Sustainability and the Soul, and her remarks today will reflect that work. Thank you, and welcome, Susan.
I contemplate a tree. I can assign it to a species and observe it as an instance. I can dissolve it into a number, but it can also happen, if will and grace are joined, that as I contemplate the tree, I am drawn into a relation, and the tree ceases to be an it. Those are the words that Martin Buber wrote in 1923 in his classic, I, Thou. I think what we're stating here today is that what we have in our society today is an I-it, not an I-thou relationship with nature. And that I-it, by the way, relationship extends to various groups within our culture, the way we view indigenous peoples, the way we view women, the way we view people of color, is also tends to be more objectifying and closer to an it than a thou. But at the same time, you know, more science is discovering intelligence in the universe and in nature. Every day I learn about something, it seems that I learn about something new, some way that plants have intelligence, extraordinary. The abstract thinking of slime mold, have you heard about that? It's quite amazing. They can solve these incredible labyrinthine problems. But we still are hanging on to this experiential attitude. We may have a cognitive recognition of intelligence and or soul or an inner life in nature, but we hang on to this idea of the universe as essentially dead. And that creates some problems for us. It leads to global warming. It leads to economic inequities. But there's also another problem, which is essentially psychological. And this psychological problem reinforces the economic and social attitudes that we have that are exploiting the earth. And that is that we can't have a meaningful relationship anymore with many of us with nature. And that's because it's very difficult to maintain or to even initiate a stimulating relationship with a corpse. So we've got some solutions, though. A solution like the steam train, which really inaugurated in many ways the Industrial Revolution. The steam train had another purpose, and that was it functioned as a kind of mechanical Viagra for both sexes, of course. It brought excitement back into life. Now, of course, the steam train promised a kind of utopia, as every new invention does. Mark Secund, for instance, who was the inventor of the wide cable suspension bridge, you know, wrote that the enjoyment, the commodities of life, which had been reserved for only men of fortune, will be shared by all classes. Now, in fact, we know that that's not at all what happened with the Industrial Revolution, nor with the steam train, that the Industrial Revolution led to terrible economic inequality as people took the train into the cities. There was a surplus of labor, and in addition to that, children were exploited in labor. But clearly, at the same time, the steam train had something really thrilling to offer, and Secund talks about that. Long ribbons of iron, along which rush, rapid as thought, those fordable machines, which seem to eat up space with a spontaneous impatience, and which seem almost alive in their breathing and their movement. So you can see the erotic nature of this great love of steam trains. So here's the incredible thing. The formidable erotic powers of the steam train seem to restore the life force that our worldview had stolen from nature, even while it was instrumental in destroying nature. Does anybody know what this is here? Bison skulls. So what would happen is on these steam trains, that went west, one of the attractions of that rail trip to the west was that the train would stop in certain places where buffalo herds roamed, and the men on the train could get off and they could shoot. And so the buffalo almost became extinct. In the early part of the 19th century, speed itself became the object of adulation. It was worshipped by many, including especially the Italian writer and founder of a movement called Futurism, F.T. Marinetti. And I'm going to read you a few words from an essay he wrote called The New Religion, Morality of Speed. The futurist morality will protect man against the inevitable decay produced by slowness, memory, analysis, rest, and habit. Human energy, multiplied by 100-fold by velocity, will dominate space and time. Velocity has given human life one of the attributes of divinity, the straight line. Velocity is naturally pure, slowness is naturally unclean. After destroying traditional good and evil, we are creating a new good, speed, and a new evil, slowness. We intend to glorify war. This is from another piece that he wrote called The Futurist Manifesto. He wrote, we intend to glorify war, the only hygiene of the world, militarism, patriotism, beautiful ideas worth dying for, and contempt for women. You see the way that all of these things fit together? Marinetti became... He was the head of what was the Futurist political party, which merged in Italy with the Fascist party. And he became a staunch supporter of Mussolini, leading to this. Doesn't that look like those bison skulls? You know, that's Florence after a bombardment in World War II. So seeing nature as dead, then we create our own deaths. But instead of questioning our worldview at any point, we simply accelerate our efforts to awaken ourselves, to re-stimulate ourselves. So we've come up with a new kind of Viagra, and that is electronic Viagra. So I thought of this when I saw an ad for some sort of, I don't know what it was, for some sort of software, something to do with computers. It was something that was a faster connection. It probably had to do with the internet, and it was faster, because speed is the most important element that is advertised for anything in the world of computers right now. So it shows a guy, and he's getting this really fast connection, and he declares, I never felt more alive. But actually, what a computer is it's a simulacrum of life, and it's dead. It's a dead simulacrum of life, what you're seeing on the screen. So once again, the claim was made with computers is that it's going to equalize everything. It's going to put us all on an equal footing, especially politically. We're going to be able to get the word out, and to some extent we can do that. But what the computer, with its speed, is best at is accumulating big data. And big data is very good for accumulating big wealth. So that's its main function in the business world. And I want to quote to you from Emma Uprichard, from the University of Warwick. She's a professor of sociology. And this is what she has to say about big data. It's being presented as the future problem solver for all things, from breast cancer to low-cost governance, from better security to predictive systems, from smart cities and better traffic and water systems to an end to urban squalor. It promises cleaner, more sustainable, renewable energy, better banking, better governance, better education for all, more efficient, faster, more cost-effective everything. If we thought utopian authors were full of hope for better futures, the public discourse of big data is akin to a future fairy godmother with a magic wand granting wishes to help solve some of the world's most wicked problems. Of course, you know, I'm not arguing here against the collection of data at all. I love the data about the 99%, for instance, versus the 1%. There's some very important data that is also being, young people are being studied, and it's found, for instance, that in the United States, young people tend to be 75 times more violent than young people in other nations. So this kind of data is useful. But numbers are stripped of the earth. They're stripped of place. I mean, the numbers, The big data, the computers have realized Marinetti's dream. They're stripped of place, time. They're stripped of also stories, breakfast, lunch, dinner, smiles, tears, empathy, emotional intelligence, not to speak of, in fact, the real erotic mysteries that come to us from sunrise, sunset, the night sky, a flight of birds, migrating south through the summer, or the eyes of somebody we love. Numbers don't have any of that. That's their virtue. They're supposedly objective, and therefore they're placed, by the way, above human responses and above us. For instance, you know, I hate public polls, and I hate polls of all kinds and questionnaires. For instance, if I'm asked, you know, have you ever been arrested? I would have to say yes, I was arrested. And then that would place me closer on a scale to a psychopath because I've been arrested. That's part of the data that makes you psych. However, it doesn't ask me what I was arrested for or why I was arrested. I was arrested once protesting apartheid, once protesting the build-up to the war in Iraq, and another time because I refused to move when I was witnessing an incident, incidents of police brutality. There's this other idea that somehow the data is never wrong, but it's often wrong because the data comes from ultimately a subjective viewpoint. This idea that an objective viewpoint is possible is not even possible in science, much less in social science. What we're doing is we're completing a sort of ultimate feedback cycle. Another way to think about it is that it's a very elaborate Ponzi scheme. You know, we're promised that we're going to get rich, but actually it's impoverishing us all. Not only is it impoverishing the environment, but we're starting to impoverish ourselves. When we impoverish our idea of the body and the way we heal and approach the body, that's a very serious lessening of ourselves, of our being. But what we're also impoverishing right now is consciousness. Ironically, we start with an epistemology saying there's an I and an it. And the I is supposed to be ensouled and have intelligence and empathy, and the it is an object. Now we're making consciousness itself into an it.
At this point, to meet our time limitations, I removed a few minutes of Susan Griffin's comments on education in the United States. We'll go to her conclusion, which follows from her beginning remarks.
I'm going to end with a quote because there are many cultures that still do carry an understanding of nature is thou and live by that. And I'm going to quote you from a poem by the Senegalese poet. I'm going to end with these words. From the Senegalese poet Tiro Seydou Sall. Having become choreographers, the stars orchestrate in their white robes tapestries of dreams, pain and joy, pulsations of love in the heart of life.
That was ecofeminist Susan Griffin. These presentations come from the New York City teach-in at the end of October called Techno-Utopians and the Fate of the Earth. Our recordings are courtesy of Dale Lehman of WZRD Radio. That's it for this week. Join me again for Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.